This is, of course, the course. Our readings this morning there was from the Midbar, Numbers 29, 12 through to 16, from the Haftarah, the prophet Zechariah 14, 1 to 21, one of the most universal of all of the Jewish prophets, really, in many ways, maybe apart from Isaiah. From the Messianic writings, we had then the book of Revelation, Yochanan's vision that he was given there on the island of Patmos, and that comes from chapter 21, and that's verses 1 through to 8. Just reminded, gory details aside of Zechariah, no one likes reading about tongues falling out of mouths and eyes dropping out of sockets, and it's a pretty gross vision in many ways of what is to come. The awesome thing, though, that Zechariah, that he really sees at the end of it all, what makes him one of the most universal of all the prophets that we have here, is his vision that at the end times, despite the nations who have gone up to fight against Adonai, the ultimate revelation comes through is that that battle, which will end nowhere, of course, no way the nations are ever going to defeat Jerusalem, never going to defeat God. This is clearly an unequal battle of warfare, if there ever was one. But at the end of it all, it says that all the nations, or actually better translated, externally translated this way, all the families of the earth, which is actually a better translation of the Hebrew, rather than nations. When we tend to think of nations, we think about modern nation states that have really only been in existence for the last 150, 200 years. Relatively recent concepts, nation states in that way. It's not the idea that's here in the scriptures. The scripture talks about the different families of the earth, with all the various language groups and so on related to that, that all of them will ultimately come up and worship Adonai in Jerusalem and during the time of Sukkot. It shows you how open this festival is in so many ways. Here we are wandering, as we are the wandering Aramaeans, are we all in many ways, sojourning on this earth, this brief years that we are given. And yet it goes on to talk about in the Numbers passage there, the different sacrifices, the 70 for the nations. Again, the concept that this is not just for us. Our role, our purpose and our task in all of this is to stand in the gap for the nations before the one true God. And Sukkot speaks powerfully to our role and our calling in all of this in many ways. Just give you one quick example here. Because, of course, you know, Shabbat comes at the end of a week of 7 days, the seven being the number of completion and order and perfection. There are seven major festivals: Pesach, Chag HaMatzot, Bikurim, Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. It's the last and the seventh one. Again, the order and completeness of it all. Not lost upon us in many ways. Ending next week with Hoshana Rabbah, Simchat Torah, which is the final one day. And we read, in that day, our God will be one, and all will be one. Mankind joined together again, worshipping the one true God, as he summarizes it all in the prophetic nature of the festivals that we're going through. The conclusion now is close. It is just a week away. But what are we going to draw down from all of this? Some wonderful things. And it's lovely, I can stand here, I can look at the sukkah, it's just awesome, it's beautiful. But there are a lot of things that we can draw from this day. We talked there briefly about the birth of Mashiach. This is the day which we assume Mashiach was born on. The historical evidence is there, it's a little circumstantial, but nevertheless, we assume this is the day that Yeshua was born. He was circumcised then on the last day of Sukkot. So an amazing thing. And we're commanded to build these sukkot in our gardens and commanded to live in them. Mazel tov if you're planning to do that, looking at the weather outside. I don't think it's going to be an easy task if you're going to do that this week. But if you're going to do it, I want video evidence. Don't come just back to me next week and just say, yeah, I did it. I'm going to say, yes, yeah, show me the video. We'll all watch it. We want proof. We want evidence if you manage to brave that out. Especially because, as you know, the roof has to have holes in. Crazy, right? Especially in this environment where it's going to rain. It has to have holes in it. If nothing else, it tells us we're meant to be keeping this festival in Israel, right? Because we know, that you can get a bit of rain this early in the season, but most of it, of course, now comes after Sukkot. But we're meant to have the holes in the roof. Because, as we've said a million times before, you need to be able to see through the roof at the stars above, to be able to see the heavens. You need to be laying on your back and looking through, praising God at his creation. And not only that, the ability to see the pillar of cloud and fire through the roof as well. And for our people, all those many, many centuries ago, back in the desert. Because who knows, at 3 a.m, our God could begin to move. We need to be able to see this, if you're awake, I guess. But the point was, you had to be able to see God. The holes had to be in the roof. That is one way of looking at it. I'm going to suggest another way of looking at it today, something completely different. In a way which is maybe a little bit shocking to us when you begin to see it. It's not so much that there are holes in the roofs that we can see out, but in the language of man, God can see in. Suddenly the perspective on the whole situation changes, because we are used to being the one there looking out and seeing what God is doing. We're not so much thinking about the fact that actually these holes in the roof there are equally there to enable God can see into our temporary dwellings, our bodies, our lives. God can see into this too. Suddenly, one of the other linkages that we have with the sukkah becomes really clear in all of this. Because it's so temporary, it's meant to be flimsy in that sense, but one of the other major themes of Sukkot is our real vulnerability. Reflecting our transient human vulnerability on earth, a position of where we are looking out to God to survive and live, and he is looking into us. That makes me feel really vulnerable. I find it actually a little bit scary when you begin to think of it in this way. Scary maybe when you think about it in this way after Yom Kippur, with all of our sins somewhat overwhelming. God is looking into our lives. Should we be scared? Should we be feeling vulnerable, overwhelmed by that thought? I think maybe we should. Maybe a little bit more of the fear of God in our lives would do us good. We're making our decisions and our choices. But it throws up another issue in all of this. And one that I've been chewing on for quite a while now, because it's very, very topical in our culture. Because if God is looking through the roofs of our lives, in the language of man, if he's looking into our lives, then there's something which becomes a real hot topic, and that topic is an issue of privacy. Now, Rabbi, you've never preached on privacy before. No, I haven't. But it's a big issue. And it needs to be stated. There's something we need to say in all of this. Because if there was ever a topic causing concern in our world, it is about privacy right now. In the middle of all of this, as we are living in our temporary dwellings this week, is an idea so stark, so strong and so powerful, a revelation which begins to hit us, the realization that before God we have no privacy. Or do we? Because you know what I'm like, right? First of all, state the principle and then undermine it. Because if you're going to find something, you've got to dig for it, you've got to find something more that is there. Because I was shocked by this. I'm sitting down just a few weeks back, I've been chewing over this theme, thinking about the holes in the roof, and just thinking to myself about this whole concept of privacy and the fact that apparently before God we have none. In fact, we sing it, do we not? Where can I go from your spirit? Can you ever leave the presence of God? We have no privacy. You know, let's just take a step into our own culture a little bit, where we're trying to chew over this idea. You know, we're living in a time right now when we're getting used to full public surveillance, 24/7, and almost total lack of privacy. And you hear the people screaming. Now, I don't know the stats about all of this, but apparently, so I hear, it's in the hundreds of times a day that we are all visible on a camera around us. That is amazingly high. Somewhere, wherever we are, wherever we're going, we are logged on a camera in the hundreds every single day. Apparently that is true. Should we be worried about this? Because there are many that are. If God can see us 24/7, should we be worried? Should we surrender to Big Brother if Big Father can see us anyway? It's a good question, isn't it? Then why are we so worried? What do we do? You know, every time I you open up Facebook and there's adverts here, adverts there of this, that and the other being put there. You know, we're all putting web-connected cameras in the name of security in our homes so we can see what's going on in our homes. Like, you really want that in Spain when you're on the beach, right? Of course you want to check what's happening to Kitty in the kitchen, right? You want to know what's going on or who's in your flat or your house or whatever. And yet those same cameras are on when you've got guests and visitors. When you're having a row with your husband or your wife. Everything being logged. Private public space becoming increasingly blurred as privacy issues begin to grow around us. Let me give you another shock in all of this. In ancient Hebrew, there was no word for privacy. Didn't exist. There's a modern Hebrew word for it, pratiyot, because in modern times we worry about these things, but maybe in ancient times God saw everything. Who needs a word like privacy? We don't have it anyway. God sees it all. So why invent a word for it, right? And we might be thinking, therefore, okay, so that's fair enough, Rabbi, we just surrender to it all, who cares how many cameras, whatever, it doesn't matter, we're all visible, everyone can see us all the time, so we're not going to worry about it, we'll just abolish all privacy and get rid of it. And here comes the real shocking surprise in all of this, because now it really gets interesting. Judaism really does have something to say about privacy. It really does. Now in Jewish thinking, privacy belongs to the area of communal holiness. It's a holiness issue, privacy. See, we're used to thinking about privacy, are we not, in our modern way, thinking about our legal rights, who's got a right to take a photo of us, a legal right to put it on the internet, the legal right to store it on some kind of data cloud somewhere or whatever. Jewish thinking is not interested in those kind of issues. In Jewish thinking, privacy is about holiness. That's a bit of a shock. There's an ethical dimension to our lives which involves the ability to be private. Let me quote you a Gentile, Balaam, the Gentile prophet, no less, Bamidbar, Numbers 24:5. What does he say? He praises Israel. He goes on to say, "How goodly are your tents, O Yaakov, your dwelling places, O Israel." Now, you may not have considered this. You may just thought, well, Balaam was just being generic. Why was he praising the tents of Israel? Good quality badger skins? Strong tent pegs? I doubt it. I doubt that Balaam is going on going, feel the quality of that. You know, guess a good tent. Yeah, how goodly are your tents, O Jacob? I wish we had some of them. I don't think that's where he's coming from. And of course, as the rabbis have always done, or you get a question like this or a statement, the rabbis go, so what does he mean? Right? Why were the tents praised in all of this? Jewish tradition furnishes us with the answer in this. The doors, and by implications the windows, I say tents, it's the temporary dwellings we were living in the desert. These temporary dwellings with the doors and the windows were always put up in such a way facing each other, but always put up in a way that the view directly onto your neighbour's dinner plate was obfuscated. You could never see into your neighbour's dwelling. How goodly are your tents, O Yaakov, your dwelling places, O Israel. Never put up just facing each other so you could literally see from door to door or window to window. They were always at a slant, always placed around. That privacy, with all the, possibly 6 million people of us that were moving through the desert at that time, that all of us, despite the huge number, still had a private sphere and space. It's a fascinating idea. In fact, this Gentile prophet praised personal family privacy. Why on earth would he do that? The answer, of course, is that in the non-Jewish world, around us at that time, where most countries, most so-called nations, as it were being run by dictators, kings, sole dictators, ruling, commanding their people, do this, do that. Personal private space under dictatorship is pretty unusual. Dictators prefer to be able to see into every single space of people's lives. Because the one thing they're looking for? Dissent. When you're going to start being a problem. Balaam comes from this background. Balaam's looking at the way all of these tents and dwellings are. He's looking at all these thinking, this is amazing. Everyone's got some space. Everyone has some privacy. Everyone's got a space that they can be. Communal holiness. Communal holiness in this kind of context was a massive radical departure from the world in which everyone else was living. Privacy unknown in the world around us at that time. We are meant to have private space. In fact, this communal holiness, this private space, unseen by others, from which you connect into the public sphere, is a lasting legacy of Jewish thinking. We are meant to be able to be private. At this point, most people tend to call out, you hear this in the media, you hear it from people who say, well, no, no privacy. You know what they're saying? If you've got nothing to hide, you won't fear surveillance. And this has nothing to do with nothing to hide. This is a holiness issue. In fact, it's more than just a holiness issue. This has to do with being able to be human and interact with others. In fact, we can ask the question, and it's a good question, can you truly be you if there is no private space in your life? Imagine. You never had a door to hide behind. Never had a place you could shut yourself away from the people around you. Never had a space anywhere where you were on your own. How would you feel? Would you go mad? I suspect most of us probably would. Most of us would be clamoring to get out into the forest or the desert or anywhere, frankly. You know, we just want to get away. Does that mean that we are maybe perpetually wearing masks when we're in public? In principle, I think we do. And you may be thinking, no way, Rabbi, I don't wear a mask when I'm out amongst people. I don't wear a mask when I'm in the community. I'm not hiding myself. Oh, really? Really? Would you be actually happy for everyone here in this room to see everything you do, hear every word you speak, and see every thought in your head? Now, I didn't think the hands would be shooting up at that point. It's a kind of scary thought though, isn't it? Because actually, if that was true, I think first of all, we'd all be really shocked. But if that was true, what we would be saying is that we would have to be, as it were, controlling ourselves 24/7 in a way that I think we would probably be exploding. Which throws up an interesting philosophical concept in all of this. It really, really does. Few people want to be that vulnerable that they wear their entire lives on their sleeves for others to see. No private space. It's not about being criminal. It's not about the thoughts you have are, you know, illegal or whatever, although some of them may be, who knows, but it's not even really about that. It's just about sometimes you need the space to sit there and to think in the solitude of your mind. It's just about being normal. It's about having some downtime for ourselves to reflect and to consider our ways. In fact, even more importantly, there are two other really important aspects of all of this as well. Let me tell you about someone who regularly took time out to be private, to have some privacy. Yeshua. Didn't he? Regularly. Did what in his public life? Was Yeshua available 24/7? Were the people around him 24/7? Continually asking him questions and picking his brain and asking him to pray for them and so on and so on? No. What did Yeshua do? He withdrew, didn't he? He withdrew from the public sphere to a private space to pray and to worship. Now, if Yeshua needed this, then I'm sure that we do too. Why do we need to pull back to a private space to pray, to worship, to chew the cud with the Lord? Without observation, I know why. I can give you one answer straight away. When I pray, when I'm in that solitary place with the Lord, it's not always an easy place. Sometimes I'm quiet. Sometimes I shout. Sometimes I'm waving my arms at the Lord. Sometimes I'm angry. Other times, I will just be kneeling and worship. And the words that come out of my mouth are my words spoken in the privacy of that quiet place, which are not meant for others to hear. Words that I might be praying for other people in a way which I feel in discernment to pray for them, which certainly are not meant for others to hear except God. Those times when those deep felt emotions and the tears are running down your cheeks, the tears that you would never want other people to see except the Lord Himself. The unspoken truths that you can only share with Him. Now add on to that the idea that intimacy demands privacy. Imagine a married couple and they have to live their lives in complete openness and public scrutiny all their lives. You say, how embarrassing would that be? But how intimate could you be? You need privacy to explore the shared space. And there are things that happen in the realm of intimacy. As I always say to couples preparing to get married, there are things that go on in that private sphere of intimacy between a man and a woman. What happens in the bedroom stays in the bedroom. It's no one else's interest. And no one else's concern. That's between you and the other and God who sees it all. But all this, you put this together, adds up to powerful arguments of why we need privacy as a communal aspect of holiness and social righteousness. This comes down to about being healthy human beings, knowing that there is a space that we can withdraw to when we need that solitude, when we need that privacy, when we need a space that no one else is looking into or sharing or has access to at that time. We need to just stand there and just go, you know, you lock the door after a Shabbat service, you've gone home, and you close the door, and you lean up against it, and you, or in my case, it's kind of, where's my bed? You know? You don't want to see me like that. I can share it with you, because I don't mind, but you don't want to see me in that condition. We need that space. I need to be able to go back and bang the top of my worktop kitchen and just say, so and so. You know? I need to be able to do that. Well, I'm human like you. I get annoyed. I get angered by things. And, you know, I need a vent. I'm not going to do that here. It's not to say I'm going to go home and sin when I'm doing that, but we need a space where we can let that out. So if we need privacy, then we have an issue, don't we? Because we're back to our sukkah again. Because if we need privacy, we suddenly discover that God gives us none. Oops. His eyes see way more than any human camera ever can. Scarily, He can see every action and hear every word and thought of our hearts. He sees and hears it all. And yet, intriguingly, with the implications of all of this, we've got to follow them through. See, the advocates of surveillance will tell us that visibility changes behaviour. It changes the way you behave. They've done experiments on all of this. They're apparently well established. In fact, every school teacher and parent knows the truth of this. You know when your little boy is about to go and smash something, and he looks at mummy and daddy and goes, uh-oh, I'm being watched. And you know what? They're likely not to break it. We see it in classrooms. I guarantee you, when I used to teach, I know this is absolutely true. If there's any child in that classroom who's about to misbehave, every single time before they do it, they'll check. Is teacher looking? Guaranteed. If teacher is looking, they won't do it. It's true. We change our behaviour if we think we are visible. That is a fact. So we think we choose maybe not to misbehave. I say it's true, but as an exception. In fact, it's not absolutely true, though, is it? Let me talk about a couple. Let me take you back in time to a couple that we know about so much who speak to this particular issue really well. And this is where it gets interesting again on a little bit more complex level. Don't forget, God sees it all. And that throws up an interesting dynamic for us when we talk about sin and how we behave and what we do and so on. Let me take you back to a couple, Adam and Chava, who in a sense tried to break the rule but prove the rule maybe in some ways. God gave them one commandment, didn't he? One commandment. And they broke it. I'll ask you the question. Did God not see them as they reached out and took the fruit? Is God not watching when they did that? Was his back turned momentarily? He was busy doing something else, creating a river somewhere, or, you know? Did he not see what was happening? Was he not there when he did this? They were visible to God and still they sinned. That's a thought for you. They were visible to God and still they sinned. We are visible to him and still we sin. Every year we have to go through Yom Kippur and yet all year long we know God is seeing every second of every day. The sin you committed yesterday, the one you thought that maybe God didn't see or you hoped he wouldn't, well, he did. The one you're going to commit later on today, that when you get there you'll think, oh, thankfully, did you see that? Well, he will. He sees it all. And still we sin. What are we going to learn from all of this? Some interesting, intriguing little levels of understanding we can draw and lessons we can learn. Let me just take you back to the garden again, because I think it's maybe not quite as obvious as we think. We read in the garden that God walked in the garden asking for them. It's a fascinating statement, it's a fascinating insight in the spiritual dynamics of what's happening at that point. God appeared to them at distance as not omnipresent, although clearly he was. Ever thought about that? Adam and Chava are hiding because of their sin. They're aware that they've sinned. They're aware that they've gone against God's teaching in all of this. And yet God is walking in the garden, calling out to them. Where are you? Did God not know where they were? Of course he knew where they were. But they perceived God in a way that he was a little bit distant from them. As if he didn't really know what had happened. And that in itself is quite fascinating because his distance, I put it in inverted commas, his distance gave them space. It gave them a privacy. It gave them a space in which they could choose and make decisions unpressured by total surveillance, or at least, as far as they were concerned, the appearance thereof. Let me put it to you again. If you think of it in this way, Adam and Chava and the tree is there and Chava is thinking, num, 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 and she's about to reach out and take it. If God had been standing literally right next to them at that moment, do you think she would have taken it? I think she would have thought more than twice. She should have gone, oops, won't touch that then. But let me put it this way to you. If that had been the case, was Chava able to make a free choice? That's an intriguing one, isn't it? That wouldn't have been a free choice. She would have obeyed, but she would have obeyed out of fear. Fear of being seen. That wouldn't have been love. Certainly wouldn't have been a free choice. fascinating, isn't it, when you think about all of this? See, God has given us free will. Yet if he was physically standing next to us 24/7, how free would you feel? Literally, think about it. How free would you feel if you were physically aware of God's presence next to you 24/7? You know, those famous wristbands that were kicking around a few years ago. What will Yeshua do? To try and remind us, to try to get us to get our heads around the concept that actually God is with us all the time and looking in. But honestly, how free would you feel? And God has given us free will. Now you can say to me, but of course, Rabbi, God is standing here and we do need to feel that. And you're absolutely right. He is. But his invisibility as pure spirit, we often feel like we're in private, don't we? You know, that moment where you're in full swing of doing something you really shouldn't be doing, but it feels like you're alone. It feels like no one can see you, no one can hear you, no one can touch you. You know, it feels like you are free. Well, the reality is, of course, you're not at that moment, but you are truly free. But none of us are truly ever in private in that way. But I think this is one of the reasons why God is invisible. Because we can't see him. Because we can't see that he's filling this room right now. It can feel like we are on our own. It feels like we're private. It feels like that we're secluded in some ways. Now I think Adam and Chava tells us this in some roundabout kind of way. You know, if God was standing there, we would be obeying through fear and not out of love. Love demands freedom to choose. But freedom to choose needs a space within which to make a choice where you are not feeling pressured one way or the other. God gave them space. He knew what they were going to do. God was there when she reached out and took the fruit. But their perception of the reality around them was that God had given them space. They perceived it that they were on their own at that point to make a choice, and in some ways they were. They had that space to reflect in private. They needed it. In fact, afterwards, when they had committed sin, God is still walking towards them. They're clothing themselves because of the realization of their sin. They had that private space, as it were, before God, where they were able to reflect and admit that they had sinned. We need that space. What God offers us is relationship, not coercion. It's really important. He never coerces us. He never pressures us. He never forces us to obey. Although he could, in all his power, he could. But he doesn't. He prefers, as it were, midrashically, philosophically, he prefers to step back and give us the space to choose and make choice and make a decision. Ask anyone who lives under a dictatorship. Fear is the way it works. And God does not want us to live in fear. I know it talks about having the fear of God, but it's about the awe of God, really. It's not meant to be living in fear in that way. God does give us space. He does give us privacy in some way. I think his invisibility virtually guarantees all of this. To be visible is to feel compelled to obey. Ask anyone who is in a prison. They're visible all the time. They know they've got to toe the line. Now, we are not in a prison. We are free. Although we are never truly alone from our God. What do we learn in conclusion from all of this? How do we piece all of this together? The strongest theme I think we can draw from all of this, really, globally, we have to say privacy is a myth. We can't be private before God. God truly does see it all. He hears it all. He knows what's in your mind right now. He knows how you're judging this sermon right now. He sees it all. But that brings us to the conclusion of all things, doesn't it? Because the issue is not if we can be seen, But who is watching? That's the real issue. Who is watching? See, the nations use surveillance for control. The nations and governments use surveillance to put down dissent. Nations and governments use surveillance to assert national values and to enforce compliance. That's what nations do. God never does this. He never forces. He never controls. He never puts down dissent. Have you noticed this? That you are free to sin. You are free to rebel against God. He's not going to stop you. You do have freedom. God doesn't stop us from making those choices. There are consequences, but He will not, never stop you. Despite seeing everything, and He does, and even giving us commandments expecting us to obey them, He never compels or enforces. We always have that choice, and He always gives us that space to make it. Yes, He is with us 24/7. Yes, He fills the space right now. He's fully here. He's literally beside each and every one of us. And yet, because He is invisible, there is that sense for us that we have a space in which we can make a choice. It's a clever way of doing this. God can see through the roofs of our lives. But the subsequent loss of privacy matters little in essence, because our God judges with righteous intent and not merely for raw obedience. Our God doesn't seek to control us. He knows us. It's why our God judges righteously. It's why when we do something, God does not just go, boom, one rule for all and everyone gets judged in the same way. He applies righteousness to us because He knows us. Ever wondered why for 20 years He ignored that sin that you were desperate to deal with, and one day He gets on with it and judges you for it and deals with it? For 20 years, did it not count for anything? No, God was merciful. He knows you. He works with you. He's not like that. He's not looking in to control or to dominate or to take over our lives. We can be free knowing God is looking through the roofs of our lives, and He's looking through into our sukkah of our lives. We can be free and to rejoice in that without feeling dominated or controlled in that way, because God does give us space, as we see from Adam and Hava. Okay, in conclusion, one final thought with all this, because it's really important. We have a problem. Our problem is that because God is invisible, we start to treat Him as if He wasn't there. And then we begin to act with a casualness towards Him, a loss of His imminent presence. We get used to thinking because we can't see Him that somehow He isn't there. That's our problem. We get casual with God. Slapdash with the commandments. Think it's okay if we just slip a bit here and slip a bit there. We try not to think that God is seeing it all, but we convince ourselves somehow He's not. That's our problem. He gives us space because He is merciful to us. He doesn't want to overwhelm us in that way. But the reality is He is omnipresent. He's with us 24/7. He sees, hears every single thing. But He gives us space to be free and to make choices. He truly does see it all. Maybe this time, as we go into this new year, maybe this is the time to be more aware of that presence. More aware that God truly does see it all. Time to pull back from that slapdash attitude which is so quickly brought into our lives. But I'd want to encourage you that as you sense His presence more around you, sense Him with you as you go through each and every day, that's not to increase fear in you, but remind yourself that He gives you the space to choose. Choose life. Choose righteousness. Do the right choices. But know that you do have the freedom to make them, because He gives us the space. even when he sees it all. Amen.